Chapter 13, Who Killed Grandma? My stint at an Edmonton radio station coincided almost perfectly with the Gretzky era. I was in the stands in 1985 when the Oilers beat Philly for their second cup. I would witness the metastasis of the West Edmonton Mall from a somewhat larger than ordinary shopping center into a thing with dolphins and submarines and its own tidal forces. I would be there for the rise and fall of Culture Club, would play the early hits of Madonna, and the hit of A Flock of Seagulls. My shaggy rugged basement suite was on the south side of town in the district of Petrolia, which promised to be charming someday when the runty little trees grew in. Grandma's neighborhood was just about as far across town as it could be. All the same, we were neighbors. Of all Annie Slorence's grandchildren, only I could be reached with a local call. I was literally her closest relative. Karma can be a bitch. One day in sunny Petrolia, I sat at my fold-up kitchen table, chatting on the phone. No sooner had I hung up when the phone rang again. "Hello," said a cheery woman. "Is this Mr. Burgess?" It was. "Oh, I have been trying to get you on the phone forever. I called and called for about half an hour, but the phone was busy."
"Talking to a friend," I explained.
"That's nice, isn't it?" the cheerful woman said. "Nice to have friends. It's hard to find the time, frankly. Life can get so busy, but it's nice to have friends like that. Young people are so sociable these days, always talking on the phone. I envy you. I really think it's great to have a lot of friends to talk to. Just great. Anyway," she concluded, "your grandmother's dead."
Later, I would wonder whether the cheery nurse employed the same phone technique with every newly bereaved relative, or whether she had just inferred my attitude toward Grandma from the infrequency of my visits. There had been exactly two over the previous year, but it's not like Grandma had noticed the lack. By that time, she was not even sufficiently aware to be annoyed. Grandma's independence in the old house on 96th Street had come to an end one day, after a final social outing. A friend had escorted her back home, shuffling her carefully into the living room and down onto a comfy green chair. The next day, when a nurse came to call, she was in the same chair, sitting in her own filth. She had sat there, unable to rise, for almost 24 hours. Grandma was moved to a nursing home. The house was sold. After it was cleaned, I ended up getting that green chair, which, all things considered, might have made Grandma happy. On my first visit to the nursing home, Grandma was wheeled out to see me. "It's Steve, Grandma," I said.
"He's not here," she said. "Do you know him?"
"Yes," I replied. "I'll tell him you said hi." That went rather well, I thought. The final visit was oddly upbeat. Staff members informed me that Grandma was convinced she was running for Prime Minister. They ushered me into the room where she lay in bed. "Hello, Grandma," I said.
"Are you a member of the community?" she asked.
I stammered a few greetings. She watched me with a mischievous little smile that was genuinely unsettling. "Well," I said, "guess I'll go now, Grandma." She raised her eyebrows.
"Good luck," she said playfully.
I had the unnerving sense of being gently mocked. Back before she needed my vote, Grandma was less inclined to cater to my feelings. On those occasions when relatives came to Edmonton, my mother, my Uncle Stan, or my brother Jock, whom she loved so dearly, it took strenuous argument to convince Grandma that I should be spared a little face time too. "But Grandma," Jock would plead, "I don't come out from Ontario very often, and Steve is my brother."
"No, you see him at Christmas sometimes. This is my visit."
Jock could manage to fight his way across town for a few hours, but if I wanted to see Uncle Stan, I had to go to Grandma's house. She would not share her only son with the likes of me. Stan was my favorite uncle, an animated, genial jester always brimming with astonished admiration for the charms and abilities of his nieces and nephews. We even had the same birthday. But Grandma brought out the worst in him. Watching the two of them was like a case study in sublimated rage. I once had a front row seat to one of their rhetorical bouts. Stan's face and neck turned a deep, frightening crimson as he rose from his chair and shouted his position. Grandma set her quivering jaw, maintaining her opposition with a mien of injured dignity. Stan crossed the room, stuck his face inches from hers, and screamed, "T-bone! They are T-bone, Mother!"
"Sirloin," Grandma huffed.
They were arguing about what kind of steaks were in the downstairs freezer. Stan lived in New Jersey and worked in New York. Margaret was in Ottawa. Joan really spent the most time with our mother, Margaret says. She was the closest to her. Joan turned 50 that year. Her red hair was well into its transformation. The bright red was fading as a clean winter white blended in. The transitory result ought to be bottled and sold. Her hair was a light, subtle auburn, kept short but full. She was slender, as always. Her style was elegant, favoring long cloth coats and sometimes a kerchief on a windy day. Strangely, there seemed to be no photos from the summer of 1976. Strange, because it was a traveling season. Joan had agreed to accompany her mother across the Atlantic on a jumbo jet. Grandma was determined to make a pilgrimage back to her hometown. In the first week of July, they embarked for Heathrow and eventually Hoyk, Scotland, the border town where young Joan Baron had grown up and where her siblings still lived. "Here I am in Hoyk," Mum wrote to us. "Please save my letters, because they will serve as a partial record of my trip." It had been my mother's first time on a 747, and she sounds excited as a schoolgirl. Simply huge. There were banks of 3 seats running down each side and a section of 4 seats down the middle. We were served dinner and breakfast. We also saw a full-length movie, Lucky Lady, with Liza Minnelli, Burt Reynolds, and Gene Hackman. We flew over the pole, and because it is July, it stayed bright as day all night. Heathrow is not a very well-designed airport. We just caught our flight to Edinburgh with no time to spare. Mum got very tired and upset. They arrived on July 5th. The trip to Hoyk was beautiful. Lovely hilly countryside, green fields and trees, long lines of stone fences called dikes. Hoyk is nestled among the hills. You don't see it until you're right on top of it. They would stay with Grandma's sister Kate at a stone house called Langhurst, set atop a steep hill. Mum was finally meeting aunts she'd only heard stories about. She seems delighted with 81-year-old Liz. "Mum gets pretty angry at Liz," she writes. "Aunt Liz is quite a gossip and doesn't mind dragging all the family gossip out of the closet, and that really annoys Mum. She really is quite rude to her at times." They drove the countryside in a rental car, various aunts in tow. Roads are so winding you rarely get above 35 or 40. Aunt Belle enjoys it because she rarely gets out, and of course Aunt Liz loves it. "Kate," Mum writes on July 15th, "is not like the others. Mum doesn't really like her at all. She's very abrupt and short of patience. I get along just fine with her. She prefers us to keep out of her way." Mum's letters are peppered with reminders for Dad, don't forget the car registration, etc., and expressions of concern. "I was sorry to hear about Ron's aunt," she writes. "He'll be feeling pretty down." If constant proximity to Grandma was driving her insane, she did not complain. But she was trapped in the barren family dynamic, and by July 16th, the strain was beginning to show. "I'll be home 2 weeks from today, and that seems like such a long time. It's really difficult to stay around the house because you really feel you're in the way and not wanted. Atmosphere is very tense. We lose the car next Thursday and we're dreading it because we've no way of getting out." The hill in front of the house was too steep for Grandma. "There are a lot of places I'd like to walk around, but I cannot because Mum can't walk and doesn't like me leaving her at all." On the 17th, "I wish I was home. I'm really counting the days until I get there." On the 19th, "Enjoy myself when we're out, but hate it at the house. Aunt Kate was particularly nasty to Mum and Aunt Liz last night. She's a very hostile person. She's okay with me, but I really find her treatment of Mum and Aunt Liz intolerable." My mother was defending her mother. It's there in the letters and in the very fact of the trip itself. Joan Burgess loves her mother. It's a thankless task. While my mother could not escape it, she knew what she was up against. "She's a dry well," Mum once said. "I have to keep telling myself it's useless to keep trying to get something she doesn't have to give." Nonetheless, whether it was love, duty, or a combination, when Grandma began her terminal decline, it would be her middle child who answered the call. Expecting gratitude would have been unwise. Toward the end of 1985, there was a momentous development in Alberta politics. Longtime Conservative Premier Peter Lougheed announced he would step aside. Transfers of power can make for nervous times in one-party states. Something similar had happened a few years earlier when Leonid Brezhnev died and Yuri Andropov took over as Soviet leader. Alberta's new strongman was Don Getty. Grandma had loved Peter Lougheed, and she was uncomfortable about the change. It didn't help that the 88-year-old was losing her grip on reality. It was at this point that Mum came to Edmonton to see Grandma through a medical crisis. Mum barely had time to visit with me on that trip. She was across town, acting as a full-time nurse and chaperone. One afternoon, she returned to the house on 96th with a load of groceries to find Grandma fixing her with a gimlet eye.
"I know where you've been," Grandma said.
"Out shopping, Mum," my mother replied.
"No, you've been out talking with them. Scheming."
"Talking to whom, Mum?"
"I know. You're meeting with them. Now that Premier Lougheed is gone, they think they can get my money."
"Who, Mum? Who do you mean?"
"The NDP. I know. They want my money, but they won't get it."
Grandma had never approved of my mother's politics. As her iron grip weakened, money became an increasingly important lever for Grandma. There were regular threats to change her will. And during one of my mother's visits, she raised another issue.
"What about the piano?"
Decades earlier, my grandparents had bought a piano for our family. The girls took lessons, but never approached the level where they would have been forced to pronounce Rachmaninoff correctly. Dad eventually donated the piano to the church, forgotten by all, except one. Grandma noted it, silently, filing the grievance away with the rest. Now the system was breaking down. Files were flying open, disgorging their contents willy-nilly.
"You owe me the money for that piano,"
Grandma demanded. She got it, down to the penny, followed by almost every gift she'd ever given us, boxed up and mailed back to Edmonton just as fast as Mum could box and mail. My mother wept over that. It was 1987 when I finally received that cheery phone call. In hindsight, my status as her only local relative might have led to some suspicious questions. Who killed Grandma? Who had the opportunity? And lots of motive. There I was. But no flatfoots inquired. Actually, if it were up to me, Grandma might still be alive. On paper, at least. Recent news reports out of Japan suggest an intriguing option I had failed to consider. Japanese citizens are renowned for their long lifespans. As of 2009, the country was home to over 40,000 centenarians. But in the case of 113-year-old Fusa Furuya, the issue of life and death turned out to be a little more vague. Furuya was identified as Japan's oldest woman, registered as living with her daughter in Tokyo. However, according to Gigi Press, when someone got around to checking up, Furuya's daughter revealed that she hadn't actually seen her mother in approximately 50 years. Other examples emerged, such as Kazuo Toshiro of Tokyo, officially 102 years old, but actually missing since the early 70s. Worst of all was the case of Sogen Kato. When Tokyo officials arrived to help him celebrate his 111th birthday, they discovered Kato's mummified remains in his bedroom. Relatives claimed he had shut himself up 3 decades earlier in hopes of becoming a living Buddha. Pension payments totaling $109,000 U.S. had been credited to Kato's account during that period. Recent withdrawals had been made. A living Buddha has no need of earthly money. I had missed an opportunity. As her only Edmonton relative in those days, I could have easily enough kept Grandma legally viable. Finally in the news, local resident Joan Annie Slorence, 114 years young today. Grandson Steve Burgess says she's doing great. Can't come to the phone right now. Lot of candles to blow out, you know. Hey, is there any prize money for being the oldest woman in town? Could you look into that? My friend and coworker Tom used to say, doesn't it ever occur to anyone that some of those bitter, lonely old people had it coming? Not my grandmother, though. She had friends. She had relatives who loved her, irrespective of a grandson's contempt. In spite of everything, the funeral of Joan Annie Slorence filled up some pews. Family would shortly begin flying in, including my Uncle Stan and Aunt Margaret. On the day of the funeral, Margaret would remain in bed with a migraine. The minister who presided at the service had never met my grandmother, but it would seem he had done some homework. He had a delicate line to walk, and he walked it like a flying Wallenda. Where Joan is now, she understands and forgives everything, and, the minister added gently, she asks for your forgiveness too. Both my mother and my uncle began sobbing. Bullseye, preacher man. Chapter 14. Luck. I have often described myself as lucky. Lucky to have been born where I was, in good health, good circumstances, and above all to Bill and Joan Burgess. But there's something insincere, something disingenuous about that sentiment. An element of pride shows through. Yes, I'm lucky. Lucky to be the thoroughly splendid fellow I am today, and talented to boot. Of course, I owe some credit to my wonderful parents. Bet they feel lucky too. If I truly acknowledge the depth and quality of my luck, it leaves no room for pride. Luck laughs at pride. So much of what we accomplish depends on the advantages handed to us. As Texas politician Jim Hightower said of the first President Bush, he was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. Luck is one of life's guilty secrets. Everyone prays for it, but few credit its true impact. I could have been born a meal rat, bred to be fed to captive snakes. I could have been born before the invention of dental anesthetic. I could have been born on La Chureca, the massive Managuan garbage dump that is home to a couple of hundred families. I could have been born to a teenager, in a neighborhood where the closest thing to industry is liquor stores and 7-Elevens, and social clubs revolve around red and blue and shooting at rivals from cars, places where luck can mean surviving long enough to end up in the Darwinian society of prison. I could be born seemingly normal, but without the simple common sense of a squirrel. Then the wheel might turn again and catapult me to fame as an O.J. Simpson juror. There's no telling about luck. Writers from Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel, to Malcolm Gladwell, Outliers, have mused on the effects of chance on the history of nations and people. Social anthropologists like Diamond make the point that the structure of our civilizations often depends on factors, arable land, climate, types of fauna, etc., not of our choosing. Like the chances of joining an exclusive fraternity, your opportunities tend to depend on where you're born. Calvinists don't believe in luck. They call it predestination. Calvinists, among others, believe God decides whether you will be saved or damned before you're even born. Then, having chosen your fate, he damns you anyway. Rather like breeding a legless dog and then beating it for not fetching sticks. It would be a handy system if we all got notified of our status via registered mail or perhaps color-coded birthmarks. A pre-damned individual could save a lot of effort regarding hygiene, loan repayments, and such. I consider it a piece of luck that our preacher daddy was no fundamentalist. Dad never bought into the restrictive message of John 14:6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. Dad knew this model was far too random. If Jesus really is the only path to salvation, how could salvation be so dependent on chance? For thoughtful Christian believers, it represents a nasty little philosophical problem. Will a baby born in Delhi, steeped in the Hindu faith of his fathers, live a rich, full life and go to his reward, eternal damnation because he lacked the good fortune to be born in Dallas and raised a Baptist? Mr. J. Calvin had no problem with it. Others find the idea rather perverse. But then, no one ever said life was fair. Why should the afterlife be different? Not for nothing did the Greeks personify the three fates who decide the course of our lives, because as we experience it, chance can seem indistinguishable from the will of an unseen force. The Old Testament story of Job, a good man afflicted by God with one calamity after another, has a contradictory sort of reassurance to it. The fact that God is doing it all on purpose at least suggests that noble Job is not simply experiencing an epic run of bad luck. That would make the story even more frightening. When it's God, you can always try sacrificing a goat. When it's pure bum luck, there's not a thing you can do. My siblings and I always understood that we had been fortunate. Throughout our lives, we experienced moments of revelatory comparison. We loved our mom and dad, but it was when we caught glimpses of other worlds that we understood our luck. My trip to the coast with Al's family was a dramatic example, but there were other small reminders from time to time. Once when I was 18 or so, a girl I knew came to the house to give me a ride to a party. Dad wandered into the dining room, said hello, and we chatted a bit before saying goodbye. On the way to the car, my friend asked, "Was your dad drunk?"
"Definitely not," I assured her.
"So, he's always like that?" she marveled.
"He seems so happy."
Some parents are cold and stern. Some can be manipulative and emotionally cruel. My friend Laura is the kind of intelligent, multi-talented, gorgeous woman that any sane parent would prattle on about until the neighbors feign choking fits just to change the subject. But while still in her 20s, she lost her mother to a drunk driver. And every year thereafter, Laura's father would write a birthday letter to his late wife. In this annual message, reliably distributed to Laura and her sister, their father would describe to his departed spouse all of the ways that his daughters had disappointed him in the past year. Wherever she was, Mum was no doubt expected to be deeply disappointed as well. Parents, health, circumstances, that's macro luck, the kind that helps to shape our destinies before we take our first steps, placing us up the track with a nice head start. Macro luck is the most easily overlooked variety. Luck, as most of us recognize it, is the day-to-day run of circumstances, the random chance that falls one way or the other. Yet even here, true luck can be hard to recognize. Back on that Brandon construction site, when my young face was impaled like a chicken kebab, I wasn't thinking, "Score!" even though the placement of that rebar was almost surgically fortunate. Just because I had a metal rod sticking out of my head doesn't mean I wasn't lucky. Later, when the drinking started, I became incontinent while passed out, regularly waking up soaked in urine. Another lucky development that motivated me to sober up. Now, the breaks I've had, it's a wonder friends don't resent me. However, nobody likes a Pollyanna. People who try to look at the bright side of every parking ticket are in denial, and also annoying. My mother has Parkinson's. There's no good side to that one. When bad luck arrives, you can only hope the damage will be limited. Perhaps some pain, some inconvenience, and a good story to tell afterward. Maybe even some flattering weight loss, as when, in the summer of 2003, fate touched my digestive system. The cozy corner restaurant on Paris's Rue Monge featured a sign with the familiar laughing, crying, theatrical masks of comedy and tragedy. Fate was giving me a heads up. Failing to take heed, I ordered the seafood spaghetti. Tragedy struck roughly 24 hours later. I was in room 13 of Hotel Esmeralda, across from Notre Dame Cathedral, when it hit with fever and shakes, my jaw chattering like that of a hunting cat, eventually settling into a 3-day subscription to the bacterial Slim Fast program. The housekeeper would peek in, see me on the bed, and flee before I could speak. On day 3, I got it out. Je suis malade! Soon a sympathetic desk clerk was leading me across the Seine to Hôtel Dieu, the old hospital beside the great cathedral. Blood tests revealed nothing serious, just another gut-twisting episode of Catch of the Day Strikes Back. Maybe the mussels or the shrimp were the main suspect, a raw oyster balanced neatly atop the plate. "Not even in season," the doctor sniffed.
"Pourquoi?" I moaned. "Did I order seafood?"
The doctor shrugged.
"C'est le destin," she said.
Fate. Next day, I sat in a cafe on Boulevard Saint-Germain, shaky, 15 pounds lighter, and almost tipsy with gratitude for my return to the world. I had planned carefully for that trip, part vacation, part travel writing excursion. But what had I been planning for? Buying the tickets, laying out the itinerary, never realizing that in so doing I was making meticulous plans to place myself in a Paris hospital with a tube emptying into my arm. That this had not been my intent was irrelevant. The doctor had been right, and so was Doris Day. Wherever you go, que sera, sera. Fate is real. Read Robbie Burns 100 times and you will still be unprepared when the plow turns up your nest and you truly understand what becomes of the best-laid plans of mice and men. Travel plans in particular are a kind of hubris. We've erased the old difficulties that stood in the way of globe-hopping, and we pretend it's all a simple matter of picking a spot on the map and then choosing your chariot. But the fates are insulted. They send their silent seafood emissaries on ahead. They lie in wait for tourists, young athletes, oblivious pedestrians, and proud engineers alike. Only months earlier, the space shuttle Columbia had disintegrated high above Texas. Some of the world's finest scientists and engineers had collaborated to make such flights possible. Billions had been spent to create the conditions that would allow seven astronauts to lose their lives in a maelstrom of shattered metal out at the edges of space. Not the plan, of course. But only on that day, February 1, 2003, the fates revealed the end result of all that work and expenditure. Perhaps that result was neither willful nor preordained, but random. Seen in review, it looks the same. What is the power of fate? How much of our experience is hostage to chance? When I consider the factors that shape character, in particular my mother's character, I think about Daniel and Leonard Fong. I wrote about Daniel and Leonard in a December 2010 Reader's Digest article. They were born in East Los Angeles to Chinese-American parents who ran a thriving little store called the Golden State Market. For the Fong family, fate arrived July 5, 1980, in the person of one John Wesley Hayes. When Hayes and two other men walked into Golden State Market, Susan Fong was working the till. Her husband, Leonard Sr., was behind the butcher counter, near where 8-year-old Daniel was playing. Susan's mother was also in the store. Hayes shot and killed both of Daniel's parents. Although young Daniel would not remember it at the time, his grandmother was also shot and seriously wounded. Later, Daniel would be a courtroom witness describing the murder of his mother and father. Daniel and Leonard were whisked off to cold Toronto to live with an aunt and uncle who didn't really want them. "We were always told we were stupid," Leonard says. "We were told that our teachers thought we were stupid. If we were 5 minutes late for dinner, we didn't eat." The boys were never given keys to the house. If they did not get home by 10 p.m., the door was locked. Both Daniel and Leonard, in turn, would be thrown out of the house before turning 18, finding temporary homes and surrogate families among their friends. They marveled at how those other families operated. "The kids had keys, their parents cooked, left them leftovers," Leonard says. "You just matched it up with your own life and thought, something's not right." Eventually, their story would take a remarkable turn. A couple of years ago, Leonard discovered the location of their parents' grave. He and Daniel had never known it, and traveled to Los Angeles to visit the cemetery. Next, Leonard decided to visit the family home on Eastern Avenue. Intending to ask permission to look around, he knocked on the door. From inside, a woman's voice said something in Chinese. Leonard held his palm down a couple of feet above the ground. "I used to live here," he said, "when I was 4 years old." The door flew open, and there stood two weeping women. One was Leonard and Daniel's aunt, the other their maternal grandmother. It turned out Daniel and Leonard had been expected for 30 years. By the time their maternal grandmother had emerged from hospital, her two grandsons were gone to Canada, and the dead parents' estate liquidated. But at the estate sale, their grandfather had stepped in, purchasing the family home in East LA. From that day on, the home was kept exactly as it had been. Not so much a shrine as a destination. The grandparents were determined never to move. Someday, they knew, the boys would come looking. The house must look as it always had. The lost boys had to be able to recognize it. As Leonard marveled over the familiar sights, even the wallpaper was the same, the room suddenly filled with aunts and uncles. "It felt like the SWAT team coming in," Leonard says. "People coming in the front door, the back door, the side door. All of a sudden, the room was full." There was a reason. The family had gathered from around the country for the funeral of Daniel and Leonard's grandfather, held the day before. The man who kept faith for so many years had reunited his family with his death, just in time to accomplish his heart's desire. Few personal histories I've heard have illustrated so clearly the two faces of fortune. But there was another aspect of that story that was equally striking to me. That was Daniel and Leonard themselves. A self-employed graphic artist, Daniel is in every sense sober, industrious, even-keeled, wise. Leonard is a top New York-based fashion photographer whose work takes him around the world. Two young men who essentially raised themselves, they would stand as a source of pride to anyone who could claim credit for the parenting job. Their horrible experiences did not slip away without effect. Daniel attributes certain personal traits, an essentially conservative nature, a tendency to go it alone, to his life experiences. Not to mention a shudder that goes through him when he hears the sound of helicopters overhead, a legacy of the police choppers that hovered in the skies of East LA on that horrible day in 1980. Yet fate could not destroy Daniel and Leonard Fong. There aren't many who would have such ironclad alibis for flying off the rails, for becoming drunks or crack addicts. People would have shaken their heads and said, with all they went through, what did you expect? No excuses necessary, thank you. Daniel and Leonard Fong are doing all right. And in their success lies the mystery of human destiny. Some are consumed by flames, while others are tempered. As many historical arguments as there are for the importance of circumstance, there are as many confounding examples of individuals who seem to have grasped circumstance by the throat and kicked its sorry ass. The human condition is no simple cake recipe. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery in Maryland, to a mother who died young and a father he never knew, and rose to become an author, statesman, and one of the greatest orators of his era. His contemporary, Abraham Lincoln, born to an illiterate father in a one-room cabin, proved to be a voracious reader who largely educated himself. Jeffrey Dahmer was born to good parents in Wisconsin, demonstrated an obsession with death at an early age, became an alcoholic in his teens, and eventually gained lasting infamy as a cannibalistic serial killer. His mother asked that her son's brain be studied for possible abnormalities. Parents always want to know the reason why. Good parents, good outcomes. A simple formula. But human cause and effect is not so clear-cut, and it wasn't necessary for us to meet Daniel or Leonard or Abe Lincoln to realize it. We only had to consider our own grandmother. How did our mother, with her grace, her discretion, her exquisite sensitivity, spring from a woman with the grace of a tuba and the sensitivity of a stuffed sturgeon? Young Joan Lawrence got some bad breaks, but her circumstances would not define her. If our grandmother was a scorching flame, our mother would come away as steel. Like the Fong brothers, she was proof personified that our destinies need not be dictated by circumstance. Character is fate, said Heraclitus. The Greek philosopher, born in the 6th century BCE, didn't believe in luck. A person's destiny, Heraclitus said, is determined by his own innate qualities. I think he meant the kind of fate that descended on Richard Nixon, whose essentially paranoid nature eventually created the enemies he imagined. He meant people like the Fong brothers, unbroken by a youth that reads like a modern-day Dickens novel. He meant people like my mother. Character was fate for Joan Burgess. Her nature trumped her circumstances. Was my mother a little lucky as well? Sometimes. The wobbling roll of a football, the chance to meet a young man who would balance her natural introversion and self-doubt with sunny optimism and a steady shower of adoration? Good luck, certainly. Eventually, she would have the good fortune to be survived by her children, though on occasion it would be a close-run thing. And in the final phase of their lives, she and her husband would have a chance to enjoy the fruits of their relationship. Whether that is really luck or the reward for hard work and perseverance is debatable. It was justice, at any rate. Mom would retire from teaching in 1989. Dad retired a year later. They began taking long walks together each morning, and on these walks their plans took shape. They would embark on their more strenuous dreams first while still physically able, and they wasted little time, embarking on a tour of Europe in 1990, donning straw hats in Venice and posing in them in front of landmarks from Vienna to London. They attended educational elder hostels around the world. They made regular tours of the kids, east to Toronto and Mississauga to visit Lynn and Jock's families, then off to the West Coast to see Leslie's family in Whistler and my bachelor digs in Vancouver, with visits to their favorite beachfront cabins in Lincoln City, Oregon, squeezed in on the way down to visit Joe and family in California. There were family reunions, church activities, community causes, good friends. In the late summer of 2006, they came west. These later visits to my West End Vancouver apartment held a special savor for all concerned. Mum and Dad would stay a block down the street at the Buchan Hotel, a quaint old pile notable for a mention in an Alice Munro story. We'd go walking in Stanley Park, and then order in pizza and watch Toronto Blue Jays games at my place, free from any obligation but enjoying each other's company. By this time I had, belatedly, reached the adult stage where one's lifestyle and apartment no longer inspired discreet parental cringes and despairing sighs. I had learned to vacuum. Clothes did not sprawl over furniture like badly trained pets. My beloved black cat had died years before, never to be replaced in my heart, never to fill another litter box with aromatic biscuits. Once, when I was living in a previous apartment, Mum and Dad had bought me a vacuum cleaner, and Mum had immediately put it to use on the accumulated cat hair. "My God," she said after the first pass, "this carpet is pink!" My new one-bedroom place was furnished with pieces I had found and shipped from Asia and Morocco. It looked good, and I knew that every time my mother saw my circumstances, she silently revisited the era when stacked crates of empty bottles perfumed a succession of squalid basement suites, mute testimony to my dangerous priorities. I knew that just sitting in my clean and well-furnished apartment gave her quiet satisfaction. On some level, that may even have been the whole point of having one. One evening, as we sat at my dining room table, Mum talked about the retirement years they'd spent, by that time almost 17 years. Most spent in good health and braced up by mutual love and support, their struggles behind them. That time was probably the best of our marriage, Dad would later tell me. As my mother turned toward me that evening at my little table, I was surprised to see her eyes were wet. Her tears may have represented simple nostalgia. They may also have been a sign of inner knowledge. As we sat there, enjoying each other's company, my mother already sensed that irreversible changes were underway. But dark forebodings were not her subject that evening. Her subject was gratitude, and her eyes were shining. "I know we've been lucky," she told me.